It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up on Central Time, does Wisconsin have a skills gap? We'll hear the results of an ongoing report on job opportunities and challenges facing Wisconsin employers and workers.
First, we're learning about a new twist in the immigration debate. Late yesterday, a federal judge in Texas ruled to temporarily block President Obama's executive actions on immigration. The actions were set to go into effect tomorrow.
Alan Gomez is here to break down the news for us. He's an immigration reporter for USA Today. Alan, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so this federal judge in Texas blocked the president's immigration plan. What did the judge say about this decision?
All right, so basically he's saying that the president definitely has some discretion to decide which undocumented immigrants to deport from the country. They refer to that as prosecutorial discretion, and he says, yes, every president's used it for 50 years, and Obama can use it as well. But by creating this large program to protect up to 5 million people from deportation, giving them work permits, giving them Social Security cards, that the president has overstepped his constitutional authority. So he blocked it for now. He's not ruling on the actual sort of the chunk of the law. What he's saying is that this has that it should go to a larger hearing to determine if it's legal. So he blocked it for now. It was set to go into effect tomorrow. So basically everything's on hold right now.
And part of the issue, too, I gather, was that whether states like Texas, which is one of the lead states here, and states like Wisconsin, which is also signed on, have standing, are in some way maybe materially harmed by the president's action.
Exactly. Most of the order that the judge wrote up, and it was a lengthy, well-thought-out, 123-page opinion. And what he was arguing throughout it is that these states, because the president would do this and protect them and allow them to stay here and work here, that they would be responsible for paying for health care for their kids. They would be responsible for medical care, for all unemployment benefits, for a whole list of things that the states would end up putting the bill for. So that's why he says that there is harm that these states can show that's going to be done to them if the president carries through this order, and that's why he allowed them to proceed with this case.
So this isn't a done deal, as you said. This is not a final ruling, but the president's action is on hold. What is the program that is now currently on hold based on what this judge said?
So if you remember, there was a program a couple of years ago, back in 2012, called the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. That program has already granted deportation protections for up to close to 700,000 undocumented immigrants. This does not affect that at all. Those folks are fine. They can stay here. Everything's great there. What it blocks is what the president announced last year to expand that dramatically. So it was going to be about another 300,000 people who are going to be able to qualify under that program. But more importantly, up to 4 million undocumented immigrants who were parents of U.S. citizens, parents of legal permanent residents, they were going to be protected, and they are also now in limbo because of this order.
So what materially changes, though, as far as enforcement? I'm guessing that this judge's order doesn't mean that the people covered in that expanded program are about to be deported immediately.
Exactly. Yeah, no, the president still can continue doing what he's doing, which is focusing what they refer to as their limited enforcement dollars on serious criminals, on undocumented immigrants that are threats to national security, that are members of gangs and things like that. So the enforcement apparatus of the United States, that's ICE, Customs and Border Protection, all those kind of folks will continue focusing solely on what they deem these higher-risk undocumented immigrants. So they will continue doing that, and the judge can't change that. All it does is change this program to formally grant them deportation protections, the work permits, the Social Security cards, all that sort of stuff.
Now, getting to the people who brought this to court, the states, a state like Texas, obviously on the border at the center of immigration, also states like Wisconsin, maybe not such a huge issue. Why so many, 26 states filing against this executive action?
Well, I mean, the easy answer for that is all 26 of those have Republican leadership running the state, be it the governor or the attorney generals in those states. Those are the ones that have signed on. So in a way, this is definitely has a very a very deep political undercurrent running through it. There was about another 12 states who opposed it, who filed briefs to support the president. Those are all coming from Democratic states. So it really comes down to sort of that political back and forth that we've been fighting over immigration for so many years now in this country. And so, yeah, it's all those Republican states. It's a lot of southern states and a lot of places that absolutely do have a lot of undocumented immigrants in those states. I mean, I think it's something like 48% of the undocumented immigrants that live in this country come from those 26 states that are suing to stop the president's action right now.
Now, the Obama administration replied quickly, saying, no, we think the president's actions are legal. This will keep going in the courts. What is the next step?
Well, the next step is they're going to file an appeal to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. A lot of people who are watching this weren't exactly surprised that this judge ruled the way he did. In previous orders, he's spoken out pretty forcefully against the actions by the president. In this order, he was very clear, calling the president disingenuous at times, saying that he's ignoring the dictate of Congress. So it wasn't that much of a surprise that this judge ruled the way he did. Now it moves over to that Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, who seems to have a different perspective. Few years ago, they ruled on a case, another Texas case, that had to do with a small city called Farmers Branch that was trying to make it difficult for undocumented immigrants to rent places to live in their city. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned that law, struck it down, and in that case, they argued that the federal government has the exclusive authority over the regulation of immigration. So a lot of people are expecting that this decision today is going to get overturned by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. Of course, it will continue being appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court, and it's up to the court whether they're going to weigh in on the case.
Now, this is states against the federal government. That's one side of the story. Now, in Congress, too, we've been watching congressional efforts to block the same program, in part by changing Homeland Security funding. No deal reached yet. Possibility of a partial shutdown of the Department of Homeland Security. Does this court ruling affect what's going on in Congress at all?
I think it does. I mean, because what you've had over these last couple of weeks is basically Republicans in the House and the Senate trying to use, as you said, that Department of Homeland Security funding bill, which is incredibly important. It funds CBP, TSA, the Coast Guard. And so they're trying to use that funding bill to block the president's order. Enough Senate Democrats have been able to kind of stay together and block it. But what this does now is Republican leadership on the Hill have already been using this ruling, saying, look, it's already been deemed unconstitutional, which isn't technically true. He just argued that they have standing. But they're trying to say that, look, this ruling shows that we're on the right track, that we need to pass this funding bill that also blocks the president's action. So I think they're going to be a little bit more emboldened to continue down that path. But we only have until February 27th, which is when the department runs out of funding. Congress is off this week, and they only get a few working days next week. So we're going to be coming very, very close to the brink of a partial shutdown for the department.
So, again, states against the federal government in federal court, Congress against the executive branch, Supreme Court may weigh in somewhere. Everybody's saying something here on this immigration issue. Very tangled. Any chance of some sort of bipartisan something, even at a small level, happening in, I don't know, the next 2 years?
I'm just trying to sit here and resist my laughter. From what we've seen out of this Congress and working with this president, I mean, I think any chance of everybody kind of coming out of this and saying, okay, now let's sit down and write a nice immigration bill that both sides can agree on, I just can't really envision that happening. They've had really good chances over the last couple of years to get something like that done. But the second that the president announced this program, he said he was pushed. He was forced to do it because Congress wasn't doing anything. Then he introduced this plan, so Congress got even more mad. So, no, I think it's just everything's going to be a little bit too raw for them to be able to come back and find some sort of compromise. Add the fact that we're rolling into 2016 and the elections, and the idea of Congress, magically suddenly coming together and passing a broad immigration bill in the face of those elections, I just can't see it happening.
So all we'll see in terms of anything changing will probably come from courts, if anywhere.
Exactly. So, one way or another, they're going to end up funding the Department of Homeland Security. I don't think any Republican is going to allow for that department to sit there unfunded for weeks, forcing all these Border Patrol agents, all these Coast Guard folks to work without being paid. I don't think that's going to come down on them pretty hard, I think, if they try to push that tax. So eventually they'll figure out a way to fund it. So, yeah, what we're left with is basically this legal battle over the president's plan. Again, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, they're up next, so that could be a matter of days. It could be a matter of weeks before they decide. But it's going to continue playing out in the courts. And in the meantime, you got these close to 5 million undocumented immigrants who right now are kind of standing there with their applications ready because this program was set to start tomorrow. And they're sort of just wondering what's going to happen. So it's everything's a little bit confusing right now. We even haven't even gotten guidance from the Department of Homeland Security about whether these undocumented immigrants should go ahead and send in their applications. So, yeah, today everybody, I think, is a little confused trying to figure out what to make of it. And unfortunately, I think we're going to be like that for the next few weeks.
Alan, we'll leave it there for now. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you. Always a good time.
That was Alan Gomez, immigration reporter for USA Today. He was with us to talk about the news that a federal judge has blocked President Obama's immigration plans.
As Wisconsin recovers from the recession and the new employment landscape takes shape, we're taking a look at where the jobs are in Wisconsin and what challenges face workers and employers.
In a 9-month investigation, Gannett Media in Wisconsin is finding out where the state's economic opportunities lie. From Wausau to Door County, they're looking at manufacturing, skilled trades, STEM jobs, and agriculture to find out where workers are needed and the challenges that employers face in hiring them. The project is called State of Opportunity.
Kevin Anderson joins us now. He's an executive editor at Gannett Lakes Group. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Veronica.
Well, let's start by asking a fundamental question. Is there a skills gap in Wisconsin?
Well, when we started this project or started looking at this project last summer, I think that's how we talked about it internally. But I think when you look at larger employment issues, we're looking at, in some cases, a skills gap, and that might be hard skills or soft skills. But I think there's also another thing playing into this, and this is, if you will, a demographic cliff. And that is, I was talking to one of our major employers here in Sheboygan County, and they said that if everyone who was eligible for employment in the next 3 to 5 years retired right at the stroke of midnight, they would lose 30% of their workforce. So I think that the baby boomers retiring is another huge thing that's playing into concerns across the board in terms of all of our major employers in the Northeast.
So in an ideal world, that demographic would retire and the next generation would step up in equal numbers to fill the jobs that they vacated. Why isn't that happening?
Well, I'll just take one element that we did. We just recently looked at trucking, and the folks in trucking said that people going into trucking school is down 50% compared with 10 years ago. And just a couple of weeks ago on NPR, you actually highlighted that people aren't going into trades like plumbing, electrician. We just highlighted that and took a look at a local employer here, Kohler. So a lot of the millennials, if you will, aren't going into the skills trade. They aren't seeing 2-year technical schools as much of an opportunity. And so I think that that's really one of the issues that we've had is that some of those skills. But again, you know, it's across the board in terms of some of the opportunities that we have. We're in a couple of months going to be starting to look at, as you say, STEM trades, and that might be healthcare, accounting, education. So it's really, you know, for me, I look at it as sometimes it's a skills gap. Sometimes people are going into areas, aren't going into areas where we still have a dramatic need here. And other times, I think it's actually we need to recruit people to our communities.
Now, to look at which industries are hiring in central and northeastern Wisconsin, what are you finding there?
It really is broad-based. So, you know, just for instance, Sargento is expanding in Kiel, going to add 180 jobs there. You know, we have constant recruitment across, the paper industry, the marine manufacturing industry, metal fabrication, trucking, again, healthcare. We're actually seeing here in Sheboygan County a huge and dramatic increase with Acuity, an insurance company here, a health savings bank here in Sheboygan, adding, thinking about doubling, adding several hundred work jobs in the future. So it really is broad-based.
To zoom in on one particular area, let's look at Sheboygan now. That is a place that you found seems to be facing low unemployment. What does that mean for employers?
Well, again, right now we are at 3.9% unemployment. We're about where we were right before the unemployment started to spike and went up to about 10 or 11% during the recession. And again, one of the things that's interesting is before we would have general general jobs fairs. Now we're having specific industries and specific companies even having jobs fairs to try to find workers. I think the other thing that's interesting about it, and this is one of the reasons why we're doing this series, is we want to communicate to our readers, and our businesses and our employers want to communicate to our readers that they are willing to train people. Internships. There's one company, Kurt G. Joa, that does big machines that makes diapers and things like that. They actually have invested hundreds of thousands of dollars just in a couple of machines to train their interns. So I think that for some people who say, well, the training's not there, that is absolutely not the case. There's internships opportunities. There's money for for training. So I think that for people who are looking to move up out of those entry-level positions into positions that really, you know, as the president of LTC says, you know, the average manufacturing worker in Wisconsin makes $53,000 a year. This is not your, you know, minimum wage entry-level position. So that's why we called it State of Opportunity. We really wanted to say this is positive and our communities have a chance to grow again.
So you've got businesses that are willing to train people and needing to find people to fill these jobs. Is that a message that's not getting out? Are people, I don't know, assuming that I don't have the skill set for that, therefore I can't apply? Is it something that's maybe shifted?
I think there's a few things. And like I said, some of the skills gap, and when you get down to sort of as low unemployment as we see in Sheboygan County, and I think we're definitely a bit of an outlier. I mean, you have to realize we had 1.9% unemployment in 1999. We are a traditionally high employment county. Some of that skills gap, to be honest, is soft skills. And we hear that a lot from HR departments. So people who lack communication skills, lack social skills in terms of getting along. And also, to be honest, you know, we hear a lot from our employers that folks will show up for 6 weeks and then stop for whatever reason, and that may be health or transportation or whatever. So there's definitely an element of the skills gap. I think, though, you're right about that message not getting out, and that's, you know, if we would have done this in a traditional way, we would have done a series looking at the skills gap. And I think, you know, people have heard that over and over and over again about skills gap. That's why we expanded it into this 9-month campaign. And we're looking at partnering with our businesses to do jobs fairs. We're even still thinking about, you know, crowdsourcing some scholarships in our areas. But we wanted to get the message out to people that said, look, the recession is starting to, you know, it's over for us. We can really help people. And as, you know, as journalists, public service folks, you know, we want to help our communities be stronger and we want to help those workers find those new opportunities. And that's, I think, what's exciting about this project for me and for all my other fellow editors and journalists.
And times have changed as you paint, you know, a picture of a lot of opportunity. To look at manufacturing now for a moment, there are some preconceptions about that field of work that may be hindering employment there. What's going on with manufacturing?
Well, and we heard this from our manufacturers. They said, you know, we know that there are a lot of retired manufacturing people in our communities, and those parents might be telling their kids, oh, you don't want to do the job I did. It was messy. It was dirty. It was, you know, not a great job. And now what's great is the manufacturers have let us into their plants, and it's a new generation. It really is manufacturing 2.0. The skills are higher. The plants are cleaner. The pay is higher. So if you learn, you know, CNC, computer numerically controlled lathes or other machines, you know, that's really an opportunity that you're going to make that, you're going to be making that kind of $50,000. Now, it may not be right out of the gate, but, you know, one of the things we're trying to do is show the wage ranges that people can expect, just so that we're honest with people about the kind of money they can make, and that, you know, really to drive that point home, these are not entry-level minimum wage jobs by any stretch of the imagination. These are jobs with great benefits, in great facilities, with world-class employers that are really have a hunger. And I would say, you know, I'm trying to paint this very positively. Then the negative possibility is that we have also heard, or I've heard, especially from my employers in my area, they have expanded in other states because they cannot find the workers here. And that is such a missed opportunity. And that's the other thing I want to really drive home, is that, you know, I think as a state, we need to start talking about this recruiting, saying, look, there's great lifestyle up here. If you like the outdoors, if you want a great quality of life, this is the place to be. And you can have that life, that American dream you've always wanted.
Well, it's interesting what you say, because we've seen a fair amount of reporting lately and over the last several years that maybe the unemployment rate is dropping, but that the jobs that are there are not jobs that you can support, say, a family on comfortably, that you might have to hold two jobs or three jobs. Are you saying that the jobs that you're seeing available and the training opportunities are jobs that will support you with one job comfortably?
It may not be one job comfortably. In our communities, I think you can. If you're making $50,000 in Sheboygan, that's a relatively comfortable lifestyle. But it's definitely, you're not talking about, you know, $20,000 a year minimum wage jobs, even in trucking, for instance, or welding rather. We looked at welding, and the, you know, people coming right out of technical school, their average wage was between $31,000 and $44,000. And so that is, to me, that is not your sort of typical minimum wage job. It may not be something where you're going to be able to afford all of the luxuries of life, but it's definitely a great place to start, and there's a lot of headroom there.
Governor Walker says that his budget focuses on helping to serve the workforce needs of Wisconsin. Have you heard from employers about whether they think that his budget is fulfilling that?
We haven't. And I mean, the budget's so new. But I would say that our employers are taking their own destiny into their own hands. And so, you know, when you look at it, our manufacturers in our area ponied up $2 million to develop the Kohler Center for Manufacturing Excellence at LTC. So I think, you know, they're not waiting for... In some ways, they're a little frustrated with government, both at the state level and the national level. But that doesn't mean that they're waiting for those government solutions to be delivered. They're, again, supporting workers to move up the ladder, to get the skills that they need to take those jobs. Even not just manufacturing, we're talking about electrical engineering training for some of the staff as well. So, again, I think, you know, the manufacturers here, they realize that there's an issue and they're trying to come up with solutions.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks.
We've been speaking with Kevin Anderson, executive editor of Gannett Lakes Group, about their project called State of Opportunity. It looks at the industries in Wisconsin with growing job opportunities. You can continue the conversation over on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A new report by the Vera Institute of Justice says that violent crime rates are down 49%, property crime down 44% from their highest point in 20 years. Sounds like good news. The report says, though, there is more to the story.
Despite the lower crime rates, annual admissions to jails nearly doubled in the 30-year time span between 1983 and 2013. Of those who are jailed, nearly 75% of them are there for traffic or other nonviolent offenses.
Fred Patrick is with us. He's the director of the Center for Sentencing and Corrections at the Vera Institute of Justice. Fred, thanks for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Rob. Good to be here.
Well, I want to start off. A lot of times people, and I'll include myself in this, use jail and prison almost like synonyms. You're focusing on jails here. Can you just explain the distinction to start things off?
Sure. Well, jails are part of the front end part of the system. So when individuals are arrested and charged with committing a crime, they're often then put in jail, whereas prisons are for sentenced individuals. Once an individual has been adjudicated and found guilty, those individuals are then in prison. Jails, by and large, hold folks who are considered pretrial, so their case is still being adjudicated by the courts.
So explain the story behind the numbers. These violent crimes are down, property crimes are down, but more people finding themselves in jail at some point in any given year.
So what we found is there's been an increasing overuse of jails in the sense that we now have almost 12 million admissions annually to jail, 11.7 to be exact. And that's almost 20 times the number of prison admissions, which is essentially the equivalent of the populations of Los Angeles and New York City combined. So in addition to the 11.7 million admissions, and by the way, some of those are repeat, what we call frequent flyer individuals, but in addition to too many folks, there's the issue of folks being there too long. The average length of stay has increased from an average of 14 days in 1983 to 23 days in 2013. And one of the problems with that is even a short stay in jail of a couple of days can be very harmful. It can be disruptive to family. It, as you can imagine, it could cause the loss of jobs, so reducing economic viability. There's research that suggests that it promotes future criminal behavior, and that individuals who spend even a few days in jail are more likely to receive a sentence and to receive a longer sentence if, in fact, they're later adjudicated as guilty and sentenced to prison.
So you can see if someone's committed a violent crime, why they might be kept in jail while awaiting trial if they're seen as a threat for more violence. But your report says that a lot of non-violent crimes, drug offenses, property offenses, even traffic ordinance violations are leading people to be in jail. How common is that?
Very common. Nearly 75% of the population of both sentenced offenders, those who are sentenced to jail time, which is generally a year or less, as well as pretrial detainees, are nonviolent. That is nonviolent traffic, property, drug, and public order offenses. So essentially, jails are becoming warehouses for mentally ill individuals who act out publicly, for whom mental health treatment and other diversionary programs would be useful. And importantly, increasingly, people are being held there simply for their inability to pay bail, because bail now is being overused. And so we've moved away from the real intended purpose of jail, which was to detain those who would be viewed as a danger to public or a flight risk.
Well, I want to take each of those in turn. people with mental illness? Why are we finding so many people with mental illness in our jails?
Well, you know, you do have some jurisdictions that have begun to think about ways to deal with mentally ill individuals in other than through the criminal justice system. But what you found sort of nationally is, you know, over time, the criminal justice response has become the primary response to dealing with mentally ill individuals who are, you know, maybe engaged in things that sort of create a public disorder concerns. And so as states nationally over the years sort of reduced the amount of funding and support for mental health resources, the criminal justice response kicked in. And so as a result, you know, in many places, jails, you know, have become a surrogate mental health system. And one of the things that we're hoping to do through the MacArthur Foundation Safety and Justice Challenge is to get jurisdictions to begin to focus on, the real purpose of jails in terms of addressing flight risk and public safety issues, and finding ways through mental health courts, through diversion programs, but finding better ways to deal with essentially public health issues.
Are there jails in the country that are trying to provide some kind of mental health treatment for the inmates as they come in?
Yeah, so in Kings County, Washington, which is Seattle, there's the Law Enforcement Assistant Diversion Program, which seeks to divert low-level drug and other offenders to community-based services. And I'm sure there are other examples out there. One of the things we want to do through the MacArthur Safety and Justice Challenge is to, again, because it's about the local reform efforts, is to get jurisdictions to begin to think about policing strategies, prosecution, jails, mental health systems, service providers, and how they can sort of look at their population, do a real analysis of who's coming in the front door, what are the underlying mental health and other issues that could be addressed outside of the criminal justice system, and not just addressed, but actually addressed more appropriately in a way that also further enhances public safety.
Now let's turn to the poverty side of this equation. You said people, low-income people, are overrepresented in our jails, in part because of bail. So something that might be considered, in terms of bail, a very low bail, $500, might be unpayable for some people.
Absolutely. As an example, in New York City in 2012, 31% of the non-felony defendants confined in the jails until the cases were resolved were being held on bails of less than $500.
So
again, you know, people who are, you know, being taken away from families, possibly having employment disrupted due to $500, essentially.
So is
and
there,
by the way, those folks may not necessarily be, if you were using sort of accurate risk assessment tools, it doesn't impute that those individuals are flight risk or are a danger to the public.
Is there any kind of movement to move away from even these low bails that someone can't afford if, as you say, they're not a flight risk, they're not seen as a threat?
Yeah, a great example of that is Kentucky. Kentucky has a statewide agency that uses a locally validated risk assessment instrument to assess all defendants, and it has allowed the court to release 70% of all of their defendants pretrial, with only 4% requiring bail. And just importantly, just 8% of the defendants released without bail were rearrested during the pretrial period, and only 10% missed a court date.
Now, there's been a lot of attention to income inequality, wealth inequality. Do you see this disproportionate jail population being low income as reinforcing these problems that we already see in the country?
Absolutely. When you look at, disadvantaged communities, also tend to be places where, some people might argue that there's over-policing. And so ultimately, the racial disparity picture does, sort of get incorporated into the jails. It's not limited to, just the prison system. There's a lot of focus on the overuse of prisons, often called mass incarceration, but it really starts at the jails, and thus the name, jails being the front door of sort of overuse of incarceration.
So we're seeing our jail populations nearly doubling, according to your report. I'm guessing there was never a policy decision at a national level saying, we need more people having stays in jail. How do we get here?
A cumulative effect. I mean, it actually, not unlike, some of the decisions that led to the the tremendous growth in the prison population. So get tough on crime era, you know, starting in the 80s and 90s. You know, a key point on the jail side is, you know, prosecutors, you know, play a huge role in the jail system, in terms of charging decisions and in terms of what they recommend to courts, that in terms of what judges may or may not impose as well. And so, you know, to the extent that many local prosecutors and sheriffs are also elected officials, you have the overlay of electoral politics and that sort of get tough on crime stuff that plays out in that regard. But no, so it wasn't necessarily sort of a, you know, 12 men in a room, so to speak, saying this is what we're going to do. But I think as the nation began to increasingly use punishment and the criminal justice system to deal with a whole, you know, array of societal issues, you know, this is one of the horrendous effects of it.
We're talking with Fred Patrick about a new report from the Vera Institute of Justice about what they call the misuse of jails in America.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from you. Have you seen this in action? Have you or someone you know been in jail for a nonviolent offense? If you are in the court or law enforcement system, do you think we're sending too many people to jail? What responsibility do you believe local policymakers have on improving conditions in jails? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We're talking about a new report from the Vera Institute of Justice saying that America's jails are being misused. Our guest is Fred Patrick, Director of Sentencing and Corrections at the Vera Institute.
We want to know what you think. Do you think the United States is filled with what's being called debtors' prisons, with too many low-income people stuck, maybe with bail they can't pay? What is the solution in your mind? What questions do you have about this report? And do you have an experience as an inmate, as somebody who works in a jail or in law or a social worker? Share your thoughts and experiences at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email talk@wpr.org. Fred, before we get to the calls, you've mentioned the consequences for the people who go to jail, more likely to end up in prison down the road. How about the costs to taxpayers of housing these people in jail for such a long period of time?
Absolutely. So we spend, as a nation, $60 billion annually on corrections. $22.2 billion of that, more than a third, is spent by local jurisdictions, essentially on jails. And so, you know, at a time in which we want to think about better use of public dollars to deal with other public policy preferences, spending way too much on jails. So in short, you know, too many people are in for too long. It's too expensive. It's not being used for the intended purpose. And it has very harmful effects in terms of a disruption of livelihoods.
Let's go to a caller. We've got Steve on the line in Dubuque, Iowa. Steve, hi.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. What do you want to bring up?
I had an experience myself, and I was pulled over for driving without a license, they were gonna put me in jail for it, you know, I managed to kind of talk my way out of it, but my point is the driving without a license was due to an OWI that I've been fighting for 13 years through the state of Michigan, and my opinion about it is I think it's a business for them, and I think they're counting on the revenue of this, and they really don't want to not have us go to jail. You know, they're making money off of us.
Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Aside from the particulars of Steve's experience, Fred, is this common that people might find themselves in jail due to various traffic-related offenses, like driving without a license in this case?
Sure. You know, as I mentioned previously, you know, traffic offenses, nonviolent property, drug, public order offenses, those are, you know, in the main lots of reasons why folks will find themselves increasingly in jail. And there are places where, you know, commercial bail is also a huge issue. And again, I want to point out that the wonderful thing about the MacArthur Foundation Safety and Justice Challenge is we're going to be seeking to identify 20 jurisdictions who are willing to really roll up their sleeves and put some serious thought and planning and do some data-driven analysis around how the system can reform to use evidence-based practices to reduce the number of folks who are unnecessarily in jail. And so we're very hopeful that we are at a time and place. And again, this MacArthur Initiative is a five-year, $75 million initial investment in local reform. I think that's huge. And so far, the interest from local jurisdictions has been terrific. So I think we're at a time and place, notwithstanding the significance of the problem, but we're at a time and place now where help is on the way. And the goal with this Safety and Justice Challenge and the Safety and Justice Network that'll come about is to really inform a national conversation. So beyond just the 20 jurisdictions, and then ultimately the 10 jurisdictions that will get even more significant funding would be the notion of having a nationwide discussion on the overuse of jails and looking to reform, city by city, county by county, our practices.
So you would be recruiting, getting applications, I guess, from cities, counties, anybody who has a jail with some kind of idea for a model project to tackle this problem?
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. So looking for better ways of targeting resources, more effective risk assessments, looking at, all aspects of the local criminal justice system, from policing, prosecutors, judges, defenders, policymakers, academia. So really looking for the best and brightest mind and asking jurisdictions to apply to be a part of the Safety and Justice Challenge and working with national organizations, in addition to MacArthur, organizations like VERA and Center for Court Innovation and others around, how we can sort of fix this huge and growing problem.
We're talking about a report from the VERA Institute with Fred Patrick saying we are overusing, misusing our jail system here in the United States. We'll go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. We've got Mike with us in Madison. Mike, hi.
Hi. Yes, so I've had several friends of mine commit suicide in prison. Most of them were charged with minor drug charges. We were all a bunch of deadheads traveling around watching the Grateful Dead, and they got busted with small amounts of drugs. I'm talking small amounts of drugs, things that they would laugh away at now. But back in the zero tolerance days, they wanted to make an example of people. So, for example, a friend of mine got busted with 5 hits of LSD. And his defense attorney sold him out completely, did nothing for him at all. He served the maximum penalty of his time, which was the full 5 years at the time. And right before his release, he didn't get out, right before his release, he committed suicide rather than continually being beaten and raped. And I used to go and visit him every few months, and every few months I'd go visit him, and it's got worse and worse and worse. And there's absolutely nothing we on the outside can do to help them in any way, shape, or form. But once again, here's, and this happened to several friends of mine.
Mike, I want to get Fred Patrick in on this. Sorry for the loss of your friends. Mike's friends, Fred, ended up in prison. In this jail report, are we seeing, again, low-level drug offenses leading to a lot of people spending hours, days, maybe weeks in jail?
So again, I think one of the purposes of this very initiative in terms of what we can do about situations like that is to begin to look at who really needs to be in jail in the first instance, right? So Mike, and my condolences, is talking about someone who ultimately made it to prison. And what we find is that individuals who spend even a few days in jail, many of whom don't need to be there, are far more likely to end up with an incarcerative sentence in prison and are likely to have a longer stay. That's what the research suggests. And so the goal would be sort of doing enough analysis and thinking and planning on the front end so that people who don't need to be in jail, so for in this instance, it could be that that individual could have been better served and society could have been better served had that person been diverted into drug treatment. And that's what this Safety and Justice Challenge is really all about, having jurisdictions sort of think about using the data, thinking about how to sort of reform a system that, again, brings into play the appropriate service providers who may do a better job at responding than the criminal justice system. And so maybe you avoid low-level, nonviolent drug offenders ending up in prison in the first place.
We had a caller named Carol who couldn't stay on the line, said she'd had a friend repeatedly end up in jail without charges ever being applied, without ever being charged with anything. Is that a common situation at our jails?
And repeat that again, so someone repeatedly...
People ending up in jail but never actually being charged with a crime, never ending up in court.
Well, I mean, I don't have the data on that. But again, one of the things we want to do through the Safety and Justice Challenge is to bring all of the parties to the table. So you want to look at things like arrest, booking, charging, all of those decisions, and look at things like time, you know, from arrest to arraignment, time before charge, you know, how long are people languishing in jails before they're even allowed to see a judge or before charges are brought. So this Safety and Justice Challenge would really begin to sort of unearth and tease out all of that data, which is where you begin to kind of figure out what are the decision points in the system that need to be worked on.
So as we wrap up, Fred, you've got this report out. What has been the response from stakeholders here, people maybe who are setting these policies regarding jails?
So it's been enormous. You know, we've had, you know, early indications that jurisdictions, you know, are interested and are going to the website and looking at the application. And so we're hopeful that there will be lots of applicants for us to choose from, for the MacArthur Foundation to choose from in partnership with the other Challenge Network members. Also, there's been enormous media interest and attention. And I think that if you think about it, what the MacArthur Foundation was hoping to do and what Vera was hoping to do via the report is to put front and center the fact that jails are indeed the front door in terms of overuse of incarceration, and that jails had been largely overlooked until now.
And we're going to leave it there. Thanks to Fred Patrick, Director of Sentencing and Corrections at the Vera Institute for Justice.
It's Mardi Gras, Fat Tuesday, the day before Lent, and it's a day packed with lots of food traditions.
It's also National Punchki Day, spelled like Pachki, pronounced Punchki. It's a big Polish tradition, especially today. Punchki are like a Polish jelly donut thing. We've linked to a Punchki primer from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel over at the Central Time Facebook page.
Also, we've been seeing king cakes at the grocery store down the street, and that's the one where there's a little baby figurine baked in, and whoever gets that in their piece of cake, they win, providing they don't break a tooth or something. Uh-huh. I think whoever gets that baby also has to buy the king cake for next year.
Also, I learned this on the internet. There's an Icelandic food tradition for today. They celebrate Bursting Day, as in eat until you burst, which is, I guess, part of the theme. What do you eat? It's a salted mutton and pea stew. Huh.
Yummy.
I think, yeah,
I
think we can make a go of that. Actually, I think that's our new restaurant venture.
The mutton and
pea
only
pea stew restaurant.
Sounds great.
Happy Bursting Day, everybody.